This podcast is produced in association with TES Leadership Recruitment Service. Having the correct school leader in place is critically important to your school and paramount to its success. At TES, we offer tailored leadership recruitment to find the next leader as unique as your school.
Hello and welcome to the TES podcast. I'm Grainne Hallahan, Recruitment Editor at TES, and today I'm going to be speaking to two school leaders about the effective organisation of senior leadership interviews. If you're interested in hearing more about this topic, we've got Mark Neild from the David Ross Education Trust presenting a webinar on the 30th of September at 4pm. Check out www.tes.com/4-schools/webinars to find out more information and to sign up. So with me today, I have Joe Facer, Principal of ARC John Keats in Enfield and regular TES contributor. You can check out Joe's articles by looking at her author page on the website. And we also have David Thomas, Principal at Jane Austen College and Strategy Director of Inspiration Trust. David has contributed to some incredibly helpful articles over lockdown, sharing his advice to other school leaders. But today we're thinking about leadership interviews.
Thank you both for joining me.
Thanks for having us.
And I thought you would be the perfect people to talk to about interviewing senior leaders because you've done so much of it. It's a tricky process. We're going to leapfrog over the shortlisting part of getting just your senior leaders, but let's imagine you've got your candidates there. You yourself have been in this position before in the past. Do we have any good interview horror stories to share? Joe, tell me about a time when an interview didn't go quite right for you.
So I want to be really, like, it was a leadership interview, but I don't think I was right for the school. And my favourite bit was they did a cull halfway through the day and the head teacher said to me, "I really don't want to put you through, but the governors are making me, so you're going through to the afternoon." And I did not get the job.
Imagine if you had got the job, though.
Confident in the knowledge that you weren't wanted.
Not at all, not even a little bit.
Oh dear, that's a bit harsh. David, have you got one equally harsh?
No, not that bad. I thought mine was bad, but it's not that bad. I just had the worst interview task, which in hindsight, I just realised how cruel it was. Which was to deliver an assembly to year seven, in and of itself, a perfectly reasonable interview task. But it was about Michael Young's theory of powerful knowledge. So I just had to do what was actually quite a fundamentally academic assembly on teaching philosophy to a bunch of 11-year-olds. And the worst thing was they had it four times because they had it from every candidate.
I'd question the need for 11-year-olds to have that assembly. That's definitely not one of the mill assembly really for year seven. I always think of it being like road safety and be nice to your friends. I think diving in with Michael Young for an interview assemblies, that's a task and a half.
It's setting the bar high for us.
So I thought we'd start off with the big questions when it comes to interviews. Joe, you've alluded to the fact that the cull halfway through. Do you think it's fair to do that to candidates? Is this good practice? Should you have an Alan Sugar style, you're fired halfway through and then get the next lot, or give everybody a chance to go through to the end and then make the decision at the end? David, what's your feeling on that? Do you like the idea of sending people home before you've got to the end of the process?
So I actually like a cull. I don't think a cull is the wrong thing to do. That sounded bad.
Just calling it a cull.
As long as it is clear in advance that that's part of the day and there's a decision point and you're not surprising people with it, then I think it's fine. I think it's fair to everyone. It's just got to be really clear in advance. You can't surprise people with it.
And do you think that the order in which you do things matters then? Like, if you're going to plan to do a refinement sounds nicer than a cull. If you're going to refine the list down at a certain point, do you then consider what order you're going to do the tasks in? Are there certain things that you feel like you can judge candidates on straight away and you can then decide after that point? Or does it not?
I like to see them teach first, because that's the non-negotiable. I think, you know, in an interview, there's so much you can misconstrue, and you can have follow-up conversations, you can do additional tasks if you think there's different bits. But if the teaching isn't good, particularly for a senior leader position, you can't have that person leading a school if they themselves can't teach really excellent lessons. So I always start with teaching. And if I don't start with teaching, I don't do a cull. Refinement.
David, do you feel the same? Has it got to be teaching first?
Yeah, I do teaching first. It says something about my character that I was also just going to go for the efficiency argument of, I do, you know, paper tasks and so on early, because you can get through lots of them and mark them quickly, and then leave the really time intensive stuff to the end.
Now, we're talking about this as if it happens over not just one day, but a series of days. And that's quite typical in leadership interviews. Do you think 2 days is the ideal? Or would you sometimes say that they need to go on a little bit longer than that? Or have you ever tried to just jam it all into one day?
I think, actually, I'm not a fan of 2 day interviews. I think it's, yeah, but I'm not, what do I know? When we were recruiting for the assistant and vice principal at Soane, we did 17 interviews in 1 day. And from that one, so like, I guess that was a 2 day process, but that was basically a 25 minute fit alignment interview. And then we did a full 1 day. But actually, in retrospect, I think you only needed a day, because you can get everything done in a day. Unless you've got a massive, if you have like 50 applicants and 30 are brilliant, you might need to do that kind of very like sifting almost. But I don't think you should pull like 4 people over 2 full days.
Mm. And I guess that is the thing with senior leadership jobs. They tend to attract the most number of applicants. You can put a post up for a physics classroom teacher and get nothing. Assistant head, they all come running. It's such a popular post, isn't it? David, how do you feel about the multiple day interviews?
I do agree with Jo. I think that sometimes you end up filling the time because you set the time aside, because you know that these interviews are supposed to be 2 days because it's rigorous. I think, you know, if you start off with your job description and you say, here are the 8 or 9 things I'm looking for, and to be able to test for these things, I think I need to do, you know, 10 hours worth of activity, then of course spread it over 2 days. But I would just start from, what do you need to be able to assess by? And then what tasks do you need them to do to be able to tell that? And if that fits in a day, I think, you know, you should try and fit it within a day. Particularly just thinking about the schools that these people are coming from, the cover implication on those. If you're recruiting for a senior leadership job, you're probably taking a really key person out of a school for a few days. Is it really worth it? I think there's a high bar for that.
Interesting. And how about thinking about your internal candidates? You're talking about taking teachers out of other schools for 2 days, but sometimes when you're appointing these posts, you're taking your own teachers out of the circuit for an interview, which when they're internal candidates, you might have a better idea about whether or not you really want to employ them. Should you always give internal candidates the chance to interview? Because I know some schools have that as a policy. Or do you still take their applications in and judge it against the others and shortlist them exactly the same? Jo, do you have any feelings about internals?
So I've not done this because I've not had that experience. But I think, you know, I've been an internal candidate, I think 3 times, and I think they just modified the day. So in one school, I was going for an assistant head position, and they made the externals teach, but I didn't have to teach because they were like, we've seen you teach, like there's no need for that. It was quite a decent modification. I don't think you should have to interview an internal candidate, because if they're not right for the role, you have a conversation, you don't take, like, it's... Interviewing is so tough, and you get really stressed, and it's high anxiety. And I do sort of think if there's no chance that you'd be appointed, and you know that for an internal, you know if there's 0 chance, don't put someone through that, is what I would think.
How about you, David? Can you see the argument for always interviewing internals?
I mean, not really. I think, like Jay said, you've got to be honest to people, I would probably be a bit more lenient in shortlisting, you know, to an internal, and I would probably want to give them the benefit of the doubt in offering them experience. And I know that then after that, I'm going to be able to give them really high quality feedback, and I'm going to want to work that into a development plan for them. And, you know, that's just helpful for me in thinking about how that person develops. So, you know, I'd look more favorably in shortlisting, but I would never have as a policy, you have to take everyone. I mean, there are so many cases that you can imagine where that wouldn't be right. So I mean, no, I wouldn't do that. I think when you're interviewing them, you want to try and put them on a par as much as you can. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm thinking about where we've done things like this. You know, in that example, Joe, you know, obviously it wouldn't have made you teach. I remember though, when we did an one for an assistant head job, and we just wanted to see people in a slightly different setting. And so also made them teach a class they've never taught. So an internal candidate, teach a class they've never taught, actually in a subject that wasn't their specialism. And just to start to try and see them, you know, can you operate outside of your comfort zone? Can you operate in the sort of situation you might have to in SLT? You know, worst case scenario, there's a gap in the timetable. You still have to pick something up. Can you cope with that?
That's interesting. I like that idea of trying to add in the rigor of a normal interview, but trying to juggle it so you don't have to go off-site or go to another school or overly complicate it. That's a quite neat way of doing it, which saves time and it doesn't disrupt the day too much. Okay, we've talked a little bit about tasks. What tasks do you think best tell how a person is, or both best predict and indicate how that candidate might fit in with your current team? Joe, what do you think about those tasks? So you obviously want the senior leader to fit in with your current senior leadership team. Which task tells you the most about how they might gel with your other existing members of staff?
So I am really not a fan of tasks. I don't like them at all. So I've done my fair share of interview tasks. I've had to, you know, put things in order of priority. I've done a fishbowl activity, my least favorite fishbowl activity ever, where before the people came in to watch the fishbowl, one of the candidates said, I think we should all just go around in a circle so everyone gets their say. And everyone nodded. And then the first woman spoke for 7 minutes. And so nobody else could speak. Anyway, I don't think it shows you anything you need to know. And actually, so when last year I did a task for interview candidates, but I didn't really use it. And although candidates spoke, they really enjoyed doing the task and it was good to fill some time because the day is a long day for them. I think that the things, the teaching and the interview.
So you would purely just have that on the interview day. You wouldn't get them to do, for example, like leading an assembly, or you wouldn't do the intro task or anything like that. It would purely just be you're happy to appoint on teaching a lesson and then interviewing them.
So I really wanted to do a task where I would just run in and be like, oh my God, you've actually got to deliver an assembly in 5 minutes. Go, go, go. And then get them to deliver an assembly. And my regional director looked at me and went, what do you think you're going to get out of that task? And he was just very scathing about it. He was like, well, you're going to put someone unprepared who doesn't know you, who doesn't know the school, under a lot of stress. Is that really what you want to do? And I think he was probably right. And, you know, we just stuck with the simple interview, teach a lesson.
No presentation either. You don't ask them to present on a certain topic or...
That's true, I did. At the start of the interview, we started with a presentation.
Oh, it's all coming out now. Okay, so we've got to the fact that you get asked to do a presentation. Do you feel like in the presentation you get to see a little bit about how they might get on with other members of your team? Is that a good point?
I made it around alignment. I was really interested in, like, there's a few things, and David's going to have this as well, where I really want to debate and negotiate, and there are a few things that are absolute non-negotiables for me, so I wanted to push them to hear whether they were happy with that.
Okay. David, is that a similar approach to you?
Yes, I think there are definitely tasks that I think are a complete waste of time, even though they're really popular. The fishbowl is like the group task where everyone tries to be the timekeeper, right?
Yeah, and then people on the outside and they watch you do it.
That sounds awful. So I would again start from, what are the things that are going to make this person successful in the job? Mm. What are the things that they need to be able to do? And how do I test if they can do those things? So I interviewed for an AP to do raising achievement. And I had Joe, forgive me, a task. But my task was I'd loaded up a bunch of school data onto a laptop for them. I gave them half an hour and I wanted them to start to work out what the strengths and weaknesses of the cohort were. Because what they're about to do is a raising achievement job where they had to look at cohorts and work out their strengths and weaknesses and think about what to do from them. And I wanted to know, you know, could this person pick out the important trends? Were they going to spot the same things that I would care about from that? So that as a task made sense. I think if you're, you know, going for senior leadership, you know, VP, principal positions, being able to check that people have got presence in a big room is a kind of thing that does make sense to me. I definitely wouldn't run in and give them an assembly with 5 minutes notice. Sorry, your regional director might have been right. I know I had to do one in an interview and I thought it was actually a really good task. Because you're testing something that is what you want from people in that job. I think assessing fit, group tasks are really hard and like fabricated tasks where you pretend to be a person and you pretend there's a situation and just, I don't know, I find them really hard to make judgments from because I find them quite stilted.
And it's so artificial, isn't it?
Yeah. I would much prefer to try and check alignment in other ways. I think I'm going to get this wrong, so please, I haven't referenced this, but I think it was Southwest Airlines in the US who used to have one interview question in their interviews that was completely non-negotiable for everyone in every position. It was something like, just tell me about a time when you've done something that like wasn't at all your job to help someone else. It was in no way part of your job description. And that was their basic filtering question. You could be the best pilot in the world, you can have the best track record, but if actually there was no time you could think of recently where you just pitched in and helped other people with something that wasn't in your job description, then they didn't want you in the company. So I think
that
work.
Because that tells you so much about a person and what they're willing to do for others and how much of a team player they are. That's a very revealing question, isn't it?
Yeah, I think you could write a question like that for most things that you care about. You know, if you're a head or you're on a senior team and you're thinking, like, how are we going to assess? And it's senior interviews, but interviews all the way down. You know what you value. Write some questions that tell you whether or not people are going to fit in with that.
You know, I've heard of some schools and some organisations that put a lot of stock in their personality tests and still ask members of staff to do personality tests before they employ them. Any strong feelings on psychometric tests? Am I using the right phrase now?
I've done them. I've had two interviews where they made me do them.
Ooh,
I didn't do anything with them. I thought they were just silently judging me as I submitted. So weird. You know, the thing came out and I thought, I don't recognise this person at all. Which, you know, not...
Why? What did it say you were?
I'd have to look it up.
Convenient.
It's definitely very uncomfortable reading, but...
Oh, really? How about you, David? Are you a fan of those sorts of tests?
Hey, what are you using it for? What's it going to tell you about? I mean, maybe it's testing if the person is a psychopath or something, and in that case, it may be a useful filtering mechanism. But there are probably better ways of finding that out. No, I wouldn't. It's not something that I would spend the time on, to be honest. I think there are better things that you can spend the time on.
Okay, so I think we've come to the conclusion that both of you feel that the panel and the panel interview is a really important point in the interview day. So we can agree it's a vital part of the interview. Who gets to be on the panel? How big should a panel be?
For which position?
Okay, so let's start with just an assistant head. What do you think, Jo? How many
want to be on the panel? It's hard. I think two or three people at a maximum. I think any more than that, and it gets quite crowded in the room. I've got real memories of interviewing in a head teacher's office, and I remember there were four of us and the candidate in, you know, June, and it was absolutely sweltering, and nobody could really concentrate. But I just think when there's so many voices, it's really hard.
Not very COVID safe either.
No, definitely.
Hey, wait, we've got to get to the COVID questions. Okay, so if you're going to have three people on the panel, obviously the head teacher, head of governors? No, David? Not not going to put the head of governors in there for your limited...
I probably wouldn't for assistant principal. I probably wouldn't. I think that and as a chair, you know, as a chair of governors, you want to be overseeing strategy of the school. You want to be doing that. You probably want to be leaving those kind of hiring decisions to the head teacher.
So definitely the head teacher, the person who would be the deputy head, who you'd be like thinking of line managing them.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's all you need, really.
Just two.
But then occasionally I think occasionally you need three people, but not always.
Okay.
Sorry, David, go on.
No, that's all right.
I went to a school where a governor was always on the panel, and actually I really liked that. Really liked, because they gave such a different perspective. But that was a very particular school with a very particular governing body, and I think they worked really hard with that governing body, so they were really aligned. So I was the head of English then, and I met with my governor every term. And so actually them being on the panel was, it was just a kind of a local community perspective, which was actually, I found really beneficial. Whereas I've worked in other schools where that wasn't the case, and a governor coming in would be like, not really know that much about the department or the school, and they just wouldn't add anything. So I think it depends on how you work with your governors anyway.
David, how about you?
I was just thinking about trying to get different perspectives in, and I'm going to give away my interview secrets for, I don't know, people who apply for a job with me. But I always do a student panel, and that is sometimes, you know, and I get the feedback from the students, and it can be insightful sometimes, and sometimes it isn't at all. But what's always really insightful is that I get one of the office team to observe and take notes from it. And that is always great. Like, the perspective they bring me back from having watched the student panel and watched the person interact in the informal bits around, as well as in the actual conversation with the students, that's always really, really useful. And how they interact with the admin team tells me a lot about them and their personality and who they are. So I really, really value that.
Yeah, I think the student panel, the feedback you'll get from the children will always just be feedback from children, and as useful as that can possibly be. But the person who watches that interaction can often give quite good insights, can't they? I think that's very true. Okay, so thinking now about the questions that the panels will ask, scenario questions seem to be super popular at the moment. Twitter is awash with people talking about different scenario questions and sharing scenario questions. Do we think it's the holy grail of interviews? Do you like them?
I did those 17 interviews I did last year. I did with my executive principal, who's one of my favourite people in the world, and he's amazing. But in one interview, he just came out with this scenario out of absolutely nowhere and was like, right, so imagine you're on the playground and there's a child on the roof. Are they going to jump? It was just, it was brilliant, because the candidate just looked at him and was like, I don't know what I'd do. And we actually gave him the job because he was so honest and like, I just have no idea. It was just, it's just my favourite.
That's not one I think anybody would prepare for either.
No, I liked it in a way, because it actually, what it uncovered was that the colleague, the way he was like thrown and then honest, he didn't in any way try and like just chat something he didn't know, which was helpful. So look, you can literally gain good information from basically anything, is what I'm saying. But I don't really use scenario questions myself.
David, are you jotting down notes there? You quite like that one. Are you going to put that into your bank of scenario questions?
It's just like, that's like the classic sort of Oxford interview where someone just sets the newspaper alight in front of you and sees how you react, isn't it? So I really don't like them. And I really don't like them because I don't think they tell you anything reliable. I think when you're asking someone a scenario question, if the scenario is, you know, putting them outside of their comfort zone, making them think, they haven't got a clue imagining. Your roof, for example, I mean, you're pointing at that person because of their honesty, but no one, frankly, can imagine what they would do in that situation unless they've done it or done something very similar to it, because it's so hypothetical. Mm-hmm. And what information do you really gain from someone's hypothetical answer about a hypothetical situation when they also know a lot of the time what it is that they think you want to hear? So I don't even gain very much information from it. I much prefer asking people very, very concrete questions about things that have happened. So, you know, I could ask someone, you know, tell me about the closest thing you've had to deal with in school to a crisis. And what was it? Tell me what the situation was. And then I can go into detail and ask them what they actually did. And you can get a layer of detail. When it's hypothetical, you can't ask any detailed questions, right? You've got to just remain at that slightly imaginary level. Whereas I want to know, you know, exactly what did you do? What went through your head? Who did you talk to first? What was the first thing you did and the second thing? And why the first and the second? And in hindsight, would you choose to do it differently? You can't have those conversations in detail about something that's hypothetical.
This is the idea of authenticity, isn't it? Just like with those role play tasks, you're not going to ever get a real authentic look into what that candidate can do. If you're going to ask a hypothetical scenario, you can only ever be given a hypothetical answer. It's quite limiting, really, when you think about it like that. Okay, so we've talked a little bit about catching people off guard and setting lights to newspapers, which sounds like a health and safety nightmare. All the school business leaders listening to this must have cringed at that point. But are you a fan of just asking wacky questions to catch the candidate off guard?
What I really like about, when I work, I've interviewed with lots and lots of different people at ARC over the last 2 years, and we always get given a set of questions, and anytime I interview with someone brilliant, they always look at me and they go, do I have to ask these questions? And they always go off script and they always ask really unexpected questions. But because I've interviewed with the people I'm working with have such great experience, I think that's great. I think when people are really expert in their field and they know what they're looking for, they can absolutely do that. Whereas if you don't really know what you're doing, don't go off piste. You're just asking.
Would you ask a question to disarm a candidate, to try and reveal something about them, to try and get an unguarded moment? Do you think there's any like merit in that?
It depends, right? So I know, you know, I did so much recruitment in the front of my mind is for a new start school. And when you're thinking about a new start school, you're thinking about like 12 members of staff who are going to work together intensely for a year. And the most important thing is that after they are great teachers, the most important thing is they will be a great team player. And that you kind of need to know a bit about them. And some people are very, very closed to interview and they're very professional. And I remember my colleague asking someone what, like, it's something really strange, but really personal about them and trying to get them to warm up a bit. I think he literally said, like, what do you do outside of work? Like, what are you interested in? What are you passionate about? Just to try and get into their character. Mm-hmm. But that was a really specific kind of interview. Like, I don't think I'd be doing that in full school. But
how about you, David? Do you think there's anything in the idea that you should try and get to see the real side of the candidate, and to do that you need to ask them something that they're not prepared for?
I struggle with it a little bit. I mean, I see why you want to try and get that outcome. I worry about how you achieve it in a respectful way. And I think the first thing in interviews is to, you know, put across the right image of your school. You know, most of the people who are coming to interview are not going to get that job and are not going to come and work for you. And how are they going to go away thinking about you and your school? And are you being respectful of them properly? So I find the idea of like trying to shock or disarm a bit difficult. For me, the way that I like to try and find out what they're really like is to go into lots of detail about not scenarios, but things that have happened, and try and get them to really, really talk to me about that. I mean, I was thinking about Joe's thing of finding people who work really well with you. Actually, I did do a recruitment thing once, and it wasn't an education. And what they did was just all the people who they were thinking about working with them got them to go for dinner with the team. And it was like they did a monthly team dinner anyway. And it was just you as one or two people would have to join their team dinner of like 10. And so it wasn't a structured interview thing, because it was just their normal team dinner that was their thing, and it was just see if someone fit in. That was probably a bit harder to do in a school setting, but I thought it was interesting as a way of just seeing someone fit in socially.
That's a task I can get on board with.
Eat.
Dinner out. I'd love that. That'd be brilliant.
Okay. I used to go for lunch. So when we had the lunch break, I would always go into the room and chat with the candidates to like just try and get to know them. My favourite time ever, I went in and I was like, oh, the sandwich plate was there, and I loaded up my plate and I was like, is no one eating any lunch? And they were like, no. And so I was like, oh, okay. So I just sat there with my sandwiches and I felt too awkward, so I just walked out. So I missed that, the one sandwich lunch. It was a really good way to get to know people, but I just couldn't just be watched eating.
Why were they not eating? That's so odd.
They were really nervous. It was three of them. And they were all really good, and they were all really nervous.
Oh, no. You feel quite sorry for them. Too nervous to eat the free sandwiches. That's a sign of an anxious teacher, to turn down the free sandwiches. Unheard of.
It is a feature of the teaching interview, though, isn't it? The waiting room where you're left with the two other people who want your job and you have to sit with them for an hour whilst people deliberate who's going to get culled and who isn't. Sorry, I forget what word, refined and who isn't.
Oh, it's awful. And yeah, I've come across some people who really put a lot of stock in that psyching out your other candidates and trying to like get into their heads during that process. But that's for a very different podcast on a different day. Okay, scoring systems. When you have a system of scoring your candidates as a way to whittling down who you're going to have. I know some schools are ruled by this and other schools take a more flexible approach. Jo, do you have to get your calculator out and start adding up your candidates' scores?
So I know HR will absolutely kill me because every time they give me the pro forma with my questions on it, and it always has the bit where I score them, and I've never yet written anything on the scoring bit because it's just so bizarre. Like, well, what you're giving them 4 out of 4 based on what criteria? What, I liked them more? No, I don't score people.
No, David.
This is the difference between the maths and the English teacher. I find it really helpful. It does quite often correlate with what my instinct would have been anyway. But I find it a really helpful process to go back through. And I have, partly I've done, you know, you do enough interviews that you start to get a bit of a benchmark in your head. Like I know what I'd use a 4-point scale. And I think I know what a 1, 2, 3, and a 4 is in my head. So I don't think it necessarily works to compare to someone else's. Like you can't take the average of different people's, different interviewers' scores or something, but it helps me.
I think it must just appeal to different sort of personality types. As you were talking then, I was thinking, I wonder if he looks at his friends and thinks, you're definitely a B grade friend, but you're my A friend.
Definitely
get a feel of the different numbers, but you know, it's when you're seeing a lot of people in one day, you can't just rely on your notes necessarily. There must be, Joe, how do you keep track when you've got lots of different candidates in front of you? If you're not using scoring, how do you make notes about which person?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really make notes. I basically rank them. So that sounds really awful, but after the interview, I just write their name, and then the next person, I think, were they a bit better or a bit less good? And then at the end, I just appoint the one that's at the top.
So a bit of comparative judgment.
Yeah, probably. I do it with someone. I think, Joe, what do you think? Were they a bit better, a bit worse? Are they a bit for us?
So when you're thinking about how you're going to improve the process each year, do you look back on how you recruited for positions in the previous academic year and then look to improve it each year? Or how often do you look at your processes to go, we need to improve on this? David, you've obviously been principal for a little while. Do you regularly look over how you've been recruiting and then think about how you might improve that?
Yeah, so we've done it a couple of times with different reasoning, actually. You know, we've done it once. We did it thinking, just how do we make this smoother? How do we make it better for candidates? How do we really put our best foot forward and make sure we're making the school look really good? And I think that was in a stage when we were a little bit newer at doing this and not quite as slick as we wanted to be. And that's the thing that people do also always just forget in recruitment. No. And we've had times, even in the last few years I've been at Jane Austen, where actually there've been people who we've rejected from a position who had a good experience on the day and have come back and we've hired for a later position. And they've been absolutely fantastic and really, really great people. We're really lucky to have them. And so it's things like that that remind me how important it is that you give a good impression. But we, you know, we've also made hiring mistakes, and we've brought on people who were really good and talented people, but who weren't the right fit for the school, or the way that they wanted to do things was just going to clash with the way that we wanted to do things, and it wasn't going to work as a team. And we've gone back and debriefed after that about, you know, how did we not pick that on the day? Yeah. There's two sides to that as well. One is, how did we not clearly enough communicate what we were about? Because I think it's both sides, you know, interviewing is us choosing them, and it's also them choosing us, right? You can't just assume that when you phone someone up, they're going to say yes.
Yeah.
And so how were we not clear enough about what we were? And also how did we not find that out by looking at them?
And now it's been quite nice, actually. It's probably the first conversation I've had in months where we've got through about half an hour speaking and not mentioned coronavirus. So congratulations, everybody. But knowing what we do know now about how you can recruit virtually and from a distance, are you going to use anything that you've done in the last 6 months or so going forward?
I mean, my big piece of learning last year was that if you have a really strong field, like, don't interview them all, do a really short phone conversation with them. And I think that, like, virtual kind of meetings have become so normal now that that's really great. That means you could not just do a 15-minute phone call, you could actually speak to them face to face without them having to take time out of their day and having to, you know, fill in an absence request. So I think that's probably something that I take forward. And actually, I worked in a school once where that was the policy, where you didn't interview anyone unless you'd had a phone conversation with them. And I should have done that more last year, because that you can get so much from a phone conversation, and probably even more from a face-to-face Teams meeting or something than you know, and that tells you so much more than like an email inquiry or an application form.
How about you, David? Are you going to bring any COVID-friendly policies from lockdown into your plans for 2020 and 2021?
I mean, I love the implied optimism that I'm not going to need my COVID-secure plans in the rest of 2020.
I hear that there's going to be a vaccine any day now, and I'm not planning on locking down ever again. So, yeah. Thinking positively.
I mean, I'm going to steal Jo's idea that she just talked about then, actually. I'm starting to think it through. I think that's a good idea to steal, but no, otherwise, you know, I think as soon as we can start interviewing and getting people to teach in person, and we tried doing teacher interviews, and it's not what we're talking about so much now, but teacher interviews when people were teaching remote lessons, it's very hard. I mean, fortunately, the people we got through doing that are gold, but that's not the same, is it?
It's not a process you're looking forward to repeating.
No.
So, okay, last question. We're imagining that all the interviews are finished now. You've got the person in post that you wanted. You have to now give feedback to those unlucky candidates who weren't right for the position. Jo, do you have a policy on how this feedback should be given?
Yeah, you know, oh, it's horrible. It is the worst part of the job, is calling someone up and telling them they didn't get the job. And actually, when I had a massive field, I was told you don't need to call everyone. And I was like, yes, it was the best thing ever. Because I hate calling people, because it's so, I think I must have called 50 people in the last 2 years. And it's just gutting when you tell them and they're sad. And then I guess the flip side of that is, if I've interviewed so many brilliant people that are actually amazing, and that, like David says, that you hope they'll come and work for you, or they'll come and work for your trust. And it's really important to give like really good feedback, so they feel like they've got something out of the day, but also to say that they have a really good experience of the school. Like, I don't really want amazing people getting a, you know, really anonymous email from me. But at the same time, I guess when I was in the position where I was letting 15 people know that they weren't going to get the job, I just couldn't sit down and call 15 people in a row. There was just no time to do that. I mean, if David's found a way to do that, I'd be really interested, because I think you should call everyone. I think it's just the demands of the reality of a really strong field mean it's not possible always.
I think David's worked out mathematically he can just get them all onto one Zoom call and just tell them all at once.
One by one, going around the gallery view, telling them their flaws. No, I wouldn't do that. I did, so in my last job before I took this one on, I had like finished work and I had a couple of weeks where I was still on their books and couldn't really start any actual work. And so I did 2 weeks of just interviewing. And that also meant just doing rejection phone calls, or like largely doing lots of rejection phone calls. So I had 2 weeks of doing like 3 or 4 rejection phone calls a day. And so it sort of got the awfulness of it a bit out of my system. I think, you know, it's just really important to get quickly to the point when you answer the phone. There's nothing worse than being on the receiving end of that call where someone is awkwardly ad-libbing, you know, please just tell me how I need to respond to this. And then I ask them if it's an appropriate time to give them feedback, just because I once remember a time when someone tried to give me interview feedback and I was at a house party and they didn't offer me the chance to say that this was actually a really bad time. I was like in the queue for the toilet in a house party as well, like, you know, the worst place. So that was bad. And so I offer them a chance to have that conversation another time, but then just get to it. I think if you then kind of switch your mind out of assessor into helper and into coach and into mentor, and like, you know, you were good and I want to help you find something in the future, and just give them that feedback and give them it in a really honest way.
Thank you so much, both of you. This has been such an enjoyable chat, and I hope to have you both on again soon. Thank you for giving up your time for this.
Pleasure.
This podcast is produced in association with TES Leadership Recruitment Service. Having the correct school leader in place is critically important to your school and paramount to its success. At TES, we offer tailored leadership recruitment to find the next leader as unique as your school.